The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Laura Bennett. This season, we're focusing on the New York Comedy Club and cultural institution Comedy Cellar, which was founded in 1982 and has since been the starting ground for comedians like Chris Rock and Jon Stewart and Sarah Silverman and many, many others. This week, I'm talking to Ian Fidance, a comedian who was recently passed at the Cellar, which is to say he recently auditioned for ESTY, the Booker, and was accepted into the Cellar's regular rotation of comics. I was very charmed to hear what a totally thrilling life development this was for him. After talking to a bunch of people who have been in the Cellar orbit for what feels like forever, I just found it fun to chat with someone who was so over the moon and wide-eyed about what it meant to enter the world of the Comedy Cellar for the first time.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
What's your name and what do you do?
Hi, my name is Ian Fidance and I'm a stand-up comic.
You are a stand-up comic. So that's I have been told that you were very recently passed at the Comedy Cellar.
Yes.
Meaning passed in the comedy
in the
world.
Comedy
parlance,
lore.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Means, you know, you've been accepted into the esteemed crew of Cellar Regular. So tell me what that was like and how recently did that happen?
Oh my goodness. Well, it happened June 16th, 2018. That was my audition, a day that will live in infamy. And I had my audition, my showcase, and it's Friday night at like 11 o'clock. ESTY comes down and watches you and you have 5 minutes. And everyone tells you, do not go over the light. Cut your set at 5 minutes. Whatever you do, do not go over the light. You know, so you're doing your set and you're kind of looking at the light. It was pretty surreal. You know, I had to follow Michelle Wolf, who is just a monster. You know, everyone just loves her and she's so good. And I got off and a couple of my friends comics were watching and they like hugged me. They're like, "Oh my God, they loved you." I'm like, "Yeah, but did ESTY?" You know.
So that's amazing. So back up a little bit. How did you get that audition? What was the road to that audition like?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate. A lot of people have kind of taken me under their wing and been very kind to me. Bobby Kelly has been a great friend in person that's really kind of been there for me. And so I've been, you know, buds with him for a bit. And then I've been friends with Nikki Glaser for a while. And, you know, I'd been working with her a bit. And Noam, the owner of the Cellar, has a podcast, Live at the Table. His producer reached out to me, asked me to do the podcast. And I went on. It was really fun. Had a good time. And
that was before you'd ever auditioned?
Right. Yeah. You know, I had done podcasts at the Cellar and, you know, my friends worked there. So I would go and kind of, you know, I'd never go to the table. But, you know, they'd invite me and it felt like Field of Dreams, like when you cross that line.
Wait,
you
so they would invite you to the table and you'd say no?
Well, initially I'd say no. And then, you know, one time I sat at the table and someone was like, "Don't be nervous. You're welcome here." I was like, "Oh my God." You know,
who was at the comedian's table when you were there?
Man, the first time it was Nikki, Carmen Lynch, Ryan Hamilton, I think Matteo Lane. They were very kind to me, but I was very trepidatious about going back there. You know, that's the thing. You never go back to the table unless, you know, you work there. So I did that and I didn't go back for a while. I was like, I don't want to push my luck, you know. I remember I talked to Bobby about going to the Cellar, getting in, and he's like, "What do you think about, you know, auditioning?" I was like, "I don't think I'm ready."
Why didn't you think you were ready?
Because I didn't feel strong enough. I still felt nervous. I knew that I hadn't had that kind of confidence that I needed. You know, I wasn't completely sure of myself or my act at the time, and I didn't want to be seen before I was ready. I was like, I gotta get stronger. I gotta get better, and I don't want to, you know, be seen, not get in, and then have to never go back for a couple of years. And he was really cool about it. He's like, "Yeah, that's great. Talk to me when you're ready." And then I ran into Noam at Sirius. Nikki was like, "Noam, do you know Ian?" And he goes, "Yeah, you know, he was on my podcast. He was great, really funny." And she was like, "I'd love to recommend him." And he goes, "Send me a tape." And I was like, "Okay, cool. I have to act like this is normal. I'm going to go shit my pants in the bathroom."
You know? Did you have a tape ready?
No, I scrambled for a tape. I had to, you know, hit up all these people and then they're, "Well, I can't really, we got to find it." And I'm like, "You got to find it. This is the most important moment of my life." So I finally got the tape and I sent it to him and he never responded back. So I was like, oh God. And then I went in one night and had dinner and I was sitting hanging out with them. And
you're just at the Olive Tree Cafe? Have
yeah, you? Yeah, yeah.
But not at the table?
Not at the table. No. I was table adjacent. You know? And so, you know, we were just talking and I was like, hey man, did you get a chance to look at that tape? And he was like, no, I didn't. Did you send it? I go, yeah. And he goes, okay, I'll put a reminder. I was like, all right. So then, like 5 days later, I got an email from Messi that said, hi, I loved your tape. I'd love for you to come in and showcase for me.
Talk to me about where you were when you got that email from Messi.
Okay. I was at Mountain Province, a coffee shop in my neighborhood. I was sitting two tables away from the register. This email came in. I was writing and I could not believe it. You know,
did you stand up in the middle of the coffee shop?
Oh, absolutely. I stood up. I started pacing. I'm like grabbing my hair like, oh, my God, is this real? Refreshing my email to be like, is this real? Is this the right address? You know, and I, you know, emailed back, was like, you know, I'd be honored. That'd be great. I'll see you this Friday.
You're like, I'll check my calendar and I'll get back to you.
Yeah, I was like, you know, Friday is not good. How about, you know, Monday?
Did you in that moment know exactly what your set would be or did you?
Yeah. Well, I had just showcased for JFL and that set went well, not well enough to get it, which is totally fine. And I just did basically that set and edited some and I ran a little bit. And then the night before my showcase, I didn't even do the set. I just went up and had fun for me and just fooled around on stage to get comfortable.
Did you practice, by the way, like for friends?
No. I mean, in the past for showcases, I've held my roommates hostage. In front of like one roommate that's from San Francisco. She's lived in the apartment for a month. And I'm like, look, I just got to get this out, you know? And but she has no other choice to be like, that's good. Yeah. And I'd actually call Bobby and was like, you know, I think I'm ready. And he goes, you think or are you? Because it's not up to me. It's up to you. You're either ready, you're confident, you're ready to kick ass or you're not. And I was like, I'm fucking ready to kick ass. And he's like, all right, good. You know? So I went that Friday and, you know, Nikki was there and her mom and sister. And they were kind of like my cheerleaders, my support team. You know, I'm trying to play it cool. You know, I'm calling my mom, chain smoking in the street. And
what'd your mom say? Does she have good pump up words?
I mean, my mom, I love her so much. She's the best. But, you know, she doesn't really know the comedy world, but she's super supportive. You know, she goes, I looked up that Comedy Cellar and they charge with a 2-drink minimum. This is really something, Ian. And I'm like, oh, I love you, mom.
Oh, you know? That's cute.
Yeah, so I'm kind of on Minetta Lane, you know, with my headphones in, dancing to music just to relax, you know. So I go in and I go down and, you know, I have to follow Michelle and I do my set. And it was like this crazy thing. I'd never been on that stage before and I just felt very at home and at ease. And everything just flowed really well and I felt really good, you know.
What do you think about that room made you feel at ease?
I mean, that room, that's just such a special place for comedians. And that is something that I've always, you know, had in the back of my mind. When I was younger, I've been in the city since 2003. Me and my friends used to go and watch shows at the Comedy Cellar, you know. It was just such a pipe dream. And the comics that have come out of that club are just bulletproof. You know, they're just so good. And to be on that stage and to, you know, I had an ex-girlfriend that was long distance and we went to a show at the Cellar and we're sitting up in the Olive Tree and, you know, she wanted me to move back to like Philly and was like, you know, you could commute and, you know, we could have a life, you know. And I'm like, look, I'm going to be working here. I'm going to be all over and you can be next to me in the car when we're going down that road or I can drop you off and I'll find someone else or I'll be alone. But either way.
Is that how you phrased it?
I'm working here. Yeah.
And she was like, thank you for your kind offer.
Yeah. Well, I was like, you know, you got to not cry while we're here. You know, some people are looking, you know. But it was just so wild. And I don't know, something was just so calming. And I've been in therapy for a while. This really helped me to be present. You know, I'm practicing my breathing, like Dr. Jen said, you know. I don't know. I just got up there and I felt it was very weird. I had thought that I was going to be a nervous wreck, but I just felt very at ease. And then my very first set there after I was passed, you know, I was dry heaving in the bathroom like, oh, my God.
So was that set that you did to audition the same set that you're doing now?
No, I changed my act around. The jokes I was doing 6 months ago, I try not to do now. Or if I do them, I change them.
So you know. What was the material of your first set? I mean, from the audition, do you remember?
I mean, it was very much like an introduction to who I am. It was very much the way I see things and you know.
Who are you? What's the way you see things?
Well, you know, I posted a picture of like me, my mom and my dad and Bonnie McFarlane, who I love so much, goes, you know, I always pictured you as an alien. And it's surprising to know that you have real life parents. I talked about, you know, being an alcoholic and being, you know, like a bisexual guy and how that's like very strange. Like people, you know, that's kind of like off-putting in this like wildly accepting world. And my last joke, I forget what I did and I don't know, but it worked.
Well, I wish we could hear it right now.
Well, you know, I'm not gonna give you my act right now. It will not be funny at all. I've learned that the hard way. You know.
All right. So you finish, and you could tell the room was into it.
Yeah, it was great. And I walked out in the hallway, and I got a hug from a couple of the comics. They're like, "Man, it sounded like they loved you." And again, I was like, "Well, I fucking know best he did," you know. And I looked over, and I saw her, and she was like smiling.
She was smiling.
Yeah, and that.
Where was she? Like leaning on a wall in the back.
She was in the corner by one of the exit doors, kind of in the dark, but I could just see this like silhouette, and you know, she stands out, this heavenly, you know, kind of like halo around her, and so I was like, "Oh my god, okay." So I went upstairs, and then you're like, "What the fuck do you do?
What do you do? You sit at the table?"
No, you fucking go outside. You chain smoke, and then you go inside, and you ask someone, "Do I leave? What the fuck do I do?" So you know, again, I'm going to use that word a lot, but I'm very fortunate. A lot of people were kind of like pulling for me and very like kind to me. You know,
did you start asking like, "Has anyone heard what Esty thought?"
I didn't ask anyone. You know, Nikki and her mother and sister came up, and they were like, "We were staying next to Esty. She was laughing." I was like, "All right, well, fucking have her say that. Jesus Christ, you know." So I'm like on top of the world, but also I have that fear of like her being like, "That was nice. That's it, you know." That was good enough for me. And I'm like, "Oh god." So she comes up and I go, "You know, I'm so thankful for showcasing for you." And she goes, "Thank you so much. I loved it. You and me will be emailing." And I'm like, "Okay." And so then I like awkwardly sit at the table and everyone is just gossip girls. Like, "What'd she say?" And I go, "Well, she said we'll be emailing." And Rich Voss was there, who is such a loving ball buster, you know, and half of them are like, "Oh my god, you're in," and then like two or three are like, "Well, that's not what she said to me." And I'm like, "What do you mean?" And they're like, "She told me yes, she told me this," and I'm like, "Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god," you know. It's so like in the air, it's so androgynous about what it is, you know. And Voss looks at me and goes, "Congrats." And I'm like, "On what?" She told me to email her. He goes, "Well, she either wants you to work her club or she wants to take you on a date. Fucking take the win, you insecure prick." And I was like, "All right." He goes, "You're in." I'm like, "Okay." So then I go up to Liz, who is a complete angel woman, and I go, she goes, "What'd she say?" I go, "She said that we're going to be emailing." She goes, "You're in." I'm like, "I'm in.
Oh,
what the
god.
Fuck?" So then so she goes, "You know, email." She told me to set it in my calendar, when to email, what to say, whatever.
Wait, so there was a special day you were supposed to wait? Like, it's just like a dating window?
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to email too soon?
Yeah. Oh. Well, she told me, you know, email the next day at a certain time. You never email past this. And other people have heard different things.
Wow.
You know, other people are like, "Well, I email on Sunday.
I believe Liz. She seems like a credible source.
Yes. I go home, and the next day I call Bobby, and I told him, he goes, "Well, you're in." And I go, "Oh my god." And you know, I start crying, and he's like, "We had a meeting and it's all good. You know, you're gonna be great. Just don't fuck up." And I'm like, "All right." So then I call my mom, and I got lost in my own neighborhood. I was on the phone with her, and I'm pacing, circling around so much. I'm like, "Where the fuck am I?" You know, and it was just so crazy. And it just, you know, really meant a lot. And then I started getting sets. And
wait, so you emailed her? What did the
emails
say?
Yes. We went back and forth about like, you know, a headshot and the bio and you know, like avails for the next week.
All right.
And everything.
So as soon as you email, it's quite clear that this is happening.
It's It's still, you know, like, where's the mistake? You know, something is off. And then I get my first set, and it was so sweet. You know, my friends that I went to college with came to watch the first set because we used to go there when we were younger. So it was just so nice. And I could see them, and, you know, I'm doing my set and a mustache hair went in my mouth. And I'm like, am I going to choke and die up here on my first set of the cellar?
Must have been a long mustache hair.
I mean, yeah, grooming was, you know, I've cleaned up a lot since then. But I was just like, what the fuck? Is this, you know, you're telling your jokes and in your head you have this other monologue going. You know, the set was fine. It wasn't my best.
Wasn't as good as the first time?
No, not at all. And I can be honest about that. You know, it was rough. It was scary. It was rough. You know, it was at the Village Underground. It's like over 200 people, you know, it's just like very intimidating. You have to follow Mateo Lane, who's a complete beast, you know, and then it's just like, holy shit.
But once you're past, she can't unpass you, can she? I mean, I guess
yeah,
she could theoretically.
She totally can.
Yeah. But would she after
totally
one
get
mediocre
unpassed
set?
Well, you never know. That's the fear. That's what fucks with your head. You know, it's a total psychological mind fuck. And, you know, Bobby said to me one time, he goes, Nikki Glaser got you in here and she's not going to keep you here. And I was like, oh, holy shit. But that's the beauty of that place. It's made me step up to be such a better comic, you know, because I got to follow these, you know, absolute powerhouse comedians. I got to follow Jessica Kirsten. I got to follow Yamanika Mateo, you know, Dave Attell. Jesus Christ, the Mount Rushmore of comedy. And you want to do well, you know, and it really forces you to step up and work harder because you're going to get lost if you don't.
Are there legendary stories circulating of comics who got passed, celebrated, did a set, and then got unpassed?
I don't know. And if there are, that's not really my story to tell. You know, I don't
like
ever want to put
really
that out there. You know, I have
really
heard
traumatic
a couple things, but, you know, I all I can do is focus on myself.
Yep.
I don't want to hear about anyone else. I don't want to think about,
gotta
I don't want to spread a rumor.
On.
I don't want to get into someone else's business. I show up to work, I do my job, and then I fucking try to stay in my lane. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Anything else is going to fuck my head up, and I'm already fucked up enough. You know, I don't want to add anything to the pot. I got enough stuff stirring around.
That
you
makes
know
sense to me.
Yeah.
What do you tell a friend who doesn't get past? You say, try again?
I mean, it's a thing of like, let it light a fire under your ass. Any no, you can swing it to being a good thing, because I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to accept no for an answer in the world of comedy and entertainment. If you don't let me in this door, I'm going to kick another one down, you know? And I think if you get rejected, it's really fucking tough. It really hurts, because it's hard not to take it personal, and it's hard not to feel as if you are not as good as. But I got a buddy who didn't get passed, and it lit such a fucking fire under his ass. He's a fucking killer every time he's on stage. And he uses that as fuel for fucking making every other chance on stage a reason to be like, see?
Has he gone back to audition at the Cellar again?
I don't believe so, no.
Would you have gone back if you didn't get past the first time?
I don't want to think about that.
Don't think about it.
You know, I mean, I know a Greyhound ticket to Delaware costs $22. You know, I know I can always be a carpenter again. I know I got a spot at old Gail's house. I could have just fucking moved back, you know? But I try not to think about that.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So I want to go back a little bit to the beginning, how you got into this whole racket.
Oh, boy. Comedy?
Yeah.
Woo!
So we went to college, and your friends were all into comedy?
No, I mean, I definitely dragged them out, you know. I was definitely like, this is what we're doing tonight.
They were not aspiring comics also.
No, no. But, you know, I didn't drink at the time, so it was like a sober activity to do, you know. But then, boy, did I end up drinking. That's how I started in comedy. I was living in a halfway house in Wilmington, Delaware.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I really tore it down, you know. And there was this feeling of like, you know what, dude, I was in such a bad place. I was like, you know what, give it a shot. Go up to Philly, do an open mic. If it doesn't work out, you know where the Home Depot is. You know how much a rope costs. Fucking go and do that, you know? So it was like this thing of just give it a shot, you know? And I went up, I a buddy of mine, we went up together. We did this open mic. It went okay. And then we got asked to do another one that night. We did. And then I started leaving work early, going up to Philly every night. And I'll never forget the first time I was in the car with a friend. And I'm going, here's what I'm going to say. Here's what I'm going to do. You know, and I say my thing. And he goes, yeah, I wouldn't really say that. Like, oh, God. You know?
So were you always into comedy when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When I was younger, the only way I could get out of trouble was by making my dad laugh. You know, I always had humor and a lot of bad shit happened when I was younger. My dad died when I was younger, and definitely laughter and funny movies and anything to distract from the reality of what was going on really helped out a lot, you know. And I'll never forget, this is so wild. It was like a month or two after my dad died. I'm 8 years old, and we had like some friends over, and they're like, you know, you're just so funny. You should be a stand-up comedian. Why don't you get up and do a little set for us? The very first thing I said, so my dad died 2 months ago, and now my grandpa's raising me. He talks a little something like this. I just like imitated my grandfather, you know? And my family, everyone was like, don't say that. Don't talk about that, you know? But I immediately went to like the dark side of things. But I started doing open mics in Philly, and that was really great. And then
what did you study, by the way, when you were in school? Did you
English education?
Got it.
Yeah.
So you thought about being a teacher? Were a teacher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that at all like doing stand up comedy?
I mean, yeah, except you're bombing every day, you know. And I've definitely had more hecklers in the classroom than I had in audiences, and those hurt more because they're kids and you can't fire back.
Like, what's an example?
I mean, I was teaching in the South Bronx. An 11-year-old immediately goes, "Mister, your haircut looks stupid," and I had to be like, "Okay, turn to page 11." You know?
Yeah. How do you recover from it?
You don't. You take it out on people later. I noticed at the time when I was doing stand up at night, I was very quick to anger, and like someone would talk and be like, "Shut the fuck up!" And everyone's like, "Dude, what's your deal?"
Yeah, you know? kills the vibe.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, I'm getting abused by a 12-year-old. You know?
Wait. So, what's the worst audience member heckle you've gotten?
Oh my god, it's usually, you know, drunk women that you know, respond and think the set is completely, you're talking specifically to them.
You deal with audience member hecklers differently than you deal with student hecklers,
right? Well, I've learned a lot that, you know, when someone like talks to you or whatever, you always repeat what they say into the microphone so that the crowd that didn't hear it can then be on your side.
Oh, that's
so
very interesting.
So they know what is going on, because if you immediately attack someone, they're like, right, oh, this guy's a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
I've also learned to fight it with kindness and love, you know, or like thank them for being there and just being like, you know, I'm glad you're here and you're having fun, but everyone else is here to have a good time, so you're ruining their fun.
Tell me about the first time you ever went to the Cellar. Do you remember?
Yeah, absolutely. I used to watch Tough Crowd when I was younger with Colin Quinn, you know, and I used to listen to Dave Attell's records when I was working construction. And when I'd like show up late or get in trouble, I'd be like, well, let's put this on. And we'd all laugh and it would be like a distraction, you know. So I remember I was like 18. I went to the Cellar with some friends and we sat and just watched comics.
What did you heard about the Cellar before you went for the first time?
Just that it was like the place to be. That's where like all the comics come from. That's where my favorite comics worked. You know, it was like this mythical place that you go, you perform, then you sit at the table and you hang out, you know. And
so you knew about the table as an 18-year-old?
I did, yeah. But I didn't know the mythology of it. I just had heard about it. And so I went there and I hung out and really enjoyed it. And it kind of stayed with me. And that's, you know, the more you get into comedy, the more you hear about these clubs and, you know, the Comedy Store in LA and the Cellar in New York, you know.
Do you remember who was performing that night?
Oh, man. I believe it was Keith Robinson, Nick DiPaolo, Bobby Kelly,
wow,
Jim Norton.
Do you remember?
And I remember I was in the hallway and I saw Bobby Kelly and I go, hey, good luck, man. He goes, all right, thanks, bud. And then just went up. And there's a joke he told that me and my roommate still repeat to each other, you know.
What is it?
It's, he came out, he goes, you ever have those big dick, little dick days where one day you just have a little dick? You're like, Mom, what's going on? And we would just like laugh and repeat that to each other, you know? And I remember like looking at the pictures, like, are we going to see Dave Chappelle, you know? And I remember I saw Attell and that was like huge. You know, I got to see him at the Cellar.
Who were your favorite comics when you were growing up?
Oh my God. You know, I really loved Bill Hicks when I was younger. I really liked the band Tool. And he played a part in their lyrics and they really liked him a lot. And so I got into him through them. And I really loved Paula Poundstone. My first comedy tapes, my mom got at Sears. It was Tim Allen, Drew Carey, and Paula Poundstone. And I also really loved Ellen DeGeneres. She had this joke about lip syncing the wrong lyrics and just saying like Vaseline over and over. I just remember that. It was like the funniest thing in the world. So yeah, I really loved Ellen, Paula Poundstone, Tim Allen, and Drew Carey.
That's the pantheon right there.
Yeah, but when I got older, you know, I loved Bill Hicks, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, Dave Attell, Patton Oswalt is one of my favorites.
So since getting past at the cellar, have you had the chance to share a stage with any of these people?
Yeah. You know, I'm really lucky. I MC at the cellar a lot. So I'm there a lot. You know, I brought Colin Quinn on stage, which was, you know, just like, so I've seen his one man shows in person so many times. To bring him on stage was amazing. The other night, Sherrod Small, I had to bring him on stage. And when I was 18, I was in the crowd and he looked at me and goes, look at this fucking Muppet. And so when I brought him on stage, I told that story. I was like, you know, it's just such an honor to be able to bring you on stage and tell everyone that you stink, you know, that like blew up. It was great. It's pretty wild. Dave Attell, he actually brings me on stage with him and we kind of have like a thing where we, you know, talk to each other in the crowd. And that's just completely surreal. You know, he just brought me on the road this past weekend. He's had me open for him a couple of times, and to be like friends with him and have him dig my comedy is just like next level, mind blowing. I look at myself in the mirror. I'm like, dude, this is your fucking life. Are you kidding me? This is your life. You know,
it's great. Working as a comic full time right now, or are you doing other stuff on the side?
I am. Yeah, I've had a million jobs to make it work. I kind of resigned myself a while ago to be like, look, you're gonna have a mismatch of jobs over and over just to kind of make this thing work. And I really try to stay in gratitude a lot because you know, with the life I lived, I should be dead like five times over. And I'm not. I'm here, which is amazing. And, you know, I try to work as hard as I can and be grateful that I'm in a position right now where I've been for the last, you know, year and a half of living in slight abject poverty to be a comic, an actor full time. And it's going really well. And as long as I compare myself to where I was a year ago, 6 months ago, 2 years ago, and I can see the progress that way, I feel much better. Because if I compare myself to other people, I'm going to go insane.
Do you perform at other clubs along with the cellar now?
I do, yeah. I'm really fortunate. The other clubs in the city have been really good to me too. Stand Up New York, New York Comedy Club. I love The Stand. You know, you put your avails in and sometimes you're hot and they love you and you work there a lot, and other times you don't get booked for 2 weeks. And you're like, well, I guess I can, you know, take up HVAC repair, you know. One night, a couple of weeks ago, I bombed at this bar show so bad. On the way home, I was looking up the civil service exam for sanitation workers. You know, I used to fix printers in the city, which was like amazing. That was so great. I'd fix like, you know, 15 printers, and you know, you make your money each printer, these Pitney Bowes machines. And it was so funny. I'd go to these like multi-million-dollar companies with like brain trusts and all these think tanks. And I'd be like, wait, our printer doesn't work. You got to fix it. We don't know what to do. And I'd go in and I'd be like, well, you know, it's unplugged. So pay me.
Do you have any comedy bits unplugged? Do you have any comedy bits about fixing printers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mine my life for my material. A lot of my material's autobiographical. You know, I'm very self-absorbed. I have a hard time thinking about anyone else but myself. I wish I could be a guy that's like, you know, microphones, they're a real crazy thing. They magnify, but really, what do you say? You know, but I can't. And so I just kind of use my own life and how I see things.
The other comics out there had to kind of define the Ian Fidance sensibility.
Uh-huh.
What would they say?
Oh my God. I don't know. You'll have to ask them. I guess.
Well, I'm asking you, what are your great themes as a comic?
I really try to spread a message of light and love. And I know the world's a real fucked up place right now, but somebody said I go to a happy, dark place where I can talk about very dark, depressing, awful things, but I kind of do it with a smile. I've really learned it's not really what you say, it's how you say it. So, you know, if I talk about, you know, a dark period in my life, I can get away with some things if I say it with a smile or like a certain sing-songy way to it, you know? I feel really good. I feel like not many people could do my material because I can get away with the way I do it. And I've worked really hard to kind of find that in myself, and I'm still evolving and everything. And I guess people could say I'm kind of like a wild, happy man.
from the clips of your stuff that I've watched, which I've enjoyed very much.
Oh, thank you.
You seem to be quite a pro at audience interaction, at
yeah.
like teeing up people in the audience to be part of your set.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that? What are your sort of strategies?
I don't know, just practice and reps and taking risks. I always try to take a risk. I always have a goal. Not so much to like word a joke a certain way, but to take a certain angle or like take a risk with it, you know. I try to make my set very conversational. I want to be the guy that is at your house entertaining you and making you feel like everything you've ever felt weird about is okay.
That's a good ambition.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite joke in your arsenal right now?
In my arsenal?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I do. There's a joke I've been working on, and I'm really, really lucky to have people. I don't want to surround myself with people that just gas me up and they're like, oh, you're great. You know, I want to hear that I suck. I want to hear that something's not working. I want to, you know, I came up in Philly and all my friends, you know, they're great comics, are real big ball busters, and they won't let you get away with shit, you know. And a buddy of mine, one time I bombed on stage, and my buddy Shane Gillis, who's really funny, he goes, how do you think that went up there?
That was the first thing you heard when you got on the stage?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. After just just bomb sweats, armpit out, you know, forehead gleaming with sweat, you know, just no one digging anything I'm saying. And it's good because it makes you go back and be like, fuck, I gotta get better, you know. And I had a friend who heard a joke I was doing and he goes, what the fuck are you thinking? That sucks. And I'm like, yeah, but it gets laughs. He's like, but they're not good. And so I got pissed and was like, fuck you. And then I went home and was like, he's right. And so I rewrote it. And then now when I do this little joke, it gets a big pop. And I'm grateful for that.
So what was the joke before you rewrote it?
I don't even want to say.
It's it was too so bad. Good, you yeah. don't want to get well, bomb sweats right now?
Yeah, yeah, right. I know. Do you have an AC? I'm sweating. My friend Hannah, actually, I ran a joke by her that working on right now that I really like. It's about pronouns, about how I love pronoun usage. And if you want to be called whatever you want, I'll do it. I'm like, I love you, baby. It's all right. You know, you want to be they, them, you're fucking they, them. Let's do it, you know. And the way I was phrasing it before was that I feel like the younger generation is cool with pronouns, but the older generation isn't because they're a generation of step-parents. They're jealous of a generation of people finally being called what they identify as. It just wasn't clicking. It wasn't like getting laughs. And she was like, well, you got to make it about yourself. How does that relate to you? And I was like, oh, fuck. I had a stepdad. And he, no matter how hard he tried, he would never be my father. So now when I do the joke, I'm like, I love pronouns because I know what it's like to hurt someone when you don't call them the proper thing because I grew up with a stepdad. And it was really tough because he would be like, you know I'm your stepdad, but I identify as your father. And then I would be like, shut up, you'll never be a real dad. Shut up, Jim. You know, and that's like hurtful. So I go out of my way to accommodate people. They want to be called a certain thing because I don't want to hurt them, you know. And that
back
just
to Jim.
That, yeah, that little twist of like make it about yourself. And it goes back to truth has really been working. And I did it the other night at this like stuffy, you know, Lower East Side show. And they loved it. It was great. It felt really good, you know, because that's also kind of like a very touchy topic. And it just felt really good to kind of have that click. And the Cellar has this thing called New Jokes that Will Silvince, who you interviewed, does on Monday and Thursday nights. And sometimes when he's out of town, I host it and I love it. It's really fun. But that's a great place for us to go up and just throw shit on the wall and see what sticks. Because the only way to get better is by failing. You got to bomb. You got to try shit out. I have to eat shit in order to figure out what I did wrong to make it better.
What do you like better, emceeing or doing regular set?
I don't know, man. It's funny. Like, I love doing regular sets anywhere I go and like stretching out, like being on the road and everything. Like, I'll headline one-nighters. I'm working my way into like headlining like kind of B rooms and everything. But
what's a B room?
A B room is like a club that's not as popular as like an A room. Like an A room's like Helium Comedy Club, you know, Punchline San Francisco. A B room is like a back of a room at a casino.
What's a Cellar?
That's like the A plus fucking room, you know, the A plus USDA choice prime beef, you know. And, you know, I headline these hamburger joints, but, you know, I'm fortunate enough to do the prime rib at the Cellar. I love doing regular sets, obviously, but hosting is such a special muscle that it helps me. I got to be so quick dealing with people in the audience. And no matter who's on stage, I have to reset the room. You know, if someone crushes, I have to kind of take a little time to settle the room and everything. If somebody bombs, I got to bring the room back up. It's like real fucking work. And you time everyone. You got to run the show on time. Things get fucked up. But it's really helped me out a ton and made me such a better comic.
So now that you've performed at all these different clubs, how is the Cellar? What sets it apart?
The Cellar has a real family vibe. Like before you're in there, you kind of get iced out a bit, you know? Like, people are nice, obviously, but, you know, you don't get really the time of day. And I think that's good because it makes you earn it eventually, you know. You can go and hang out, but there's like a certain line you like don't cross in the back, you know. A lot of my friends started working there and I would go and hang with them. And that made me feel more comfortable sitting around and just being. But the Cellar has a really, really big family vibe. And like the staff, everyone knows your name. Everyone is kind. I become like really close with the staff. You know, when I show up, sometimes I'll have, you know, I don't drink, so they'll have a Pellegrino waiting with my name on a napkin, which is like so fun. You know, it like makes going to work fun.
When you think back to the euphoria of that first email from SD and the doors that the Cellar would open for you and imagining that path, has it all delivered?
Oh, tenfold.
How so?
It's a completely magical place. You know, like I've gotten so much work from just being a seller comic. I feel like everyone that works there is really good at what they do, you know, and it has such a prestige with it. And I know I have so much further to go. You know, I'm not there yet. I never want to feel like, oh, I made it, you know, and I always want to be working harder and getting better. And that place really inspires me. I mean, the friendships I've had because of the seller, opportunities where I've opened for people. You know, I told you off air, I opened for Judah Friedlander, and a woman contacted him and saw my name opening for him. And she goes, hey, can you get me in touch with Ian? I want to bring him to Europe. I heard him on his podcast. And I'm like, what the fuck?
Did you go to
what
Europe?
What is this? No, she put a tour together for me. I'm touring Europe in the fall.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And
really
Judah,
wild.
You know, Judah vouched for me. She brought out Todd Barry and he had good things to say. It's just like the life I live is just so fucking crazy.
Does your mom get it yet?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I call and share it with her. And she's, you know, so excited. And I share things with her. Like when I used to teach, I used to call her leaving the school stairs and I'd be like, you know, today was a good day. Or, you know, a kid threw a thing at me and I'd be like, you know, crying. And then now I call her. I'm like, you'll never guess, you know, and she doesn't know who the people are, but she's like, that's just so wonderful, Ian, you know? And like I said, David Attell started to take me out and I actually met my girlfriend outside the cellar. I was talking to Attell outside. It was New Joke Night. I went up and, you know, performed. And then he brought me on stage with him. And we like bantered back and forth. And afterwards, we're like smoking cigarettes outside the cellar. And this kid came up and was like, hey, you know, I've always wanted to be a comic. And we're like, okay, see you later. We kind of like turn our backs. Like, what the fuck? And then this girl comes up and she goes, Nick, stop bothering them. They want to be left alone. Hey, you guys are great. I see you later. And I go, oh, wait, you said you wanted to be a comic. Well, let me tell you all about it, kiddo. You know,
was it her brother?
It was her brother. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then I was like, you know what? I'm going to take a shot. I'm confident. I'm a seller comic. Why not? You know? So I wrote my number on a piece of paper. I was like, hey, I dig you. If you want, you should give me a call. And I gave her my number and she hit me up and it was the end of July. And
wow.
Now she's my little honeycomb.
She's your little honeycomb. I feel like it's a good spot to be in, standing next to Dave Attell casually outside the cellar.
I know,
it's a
right?
Good position.
Like, what is my fucking life, you know?
Wait, did they hear you that night? I mean, did they?
They did, yeah.
Oh, so you're like a
celebrity. And I was on stage. I was talking about loving Ska and eating pussy. Yeah. And she was like, those are my two favorite things.
Oh,
I was
perfect.
Like, this is
match
great.
In heaven.
You know? Yeah, 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 right? I know.
In your dreams, where would you be, say, 10 years from now?
I got to be honest, I try not to think anything ahead of like my next 2 months avails, because if I start to plan for the future, I don't know what's going to happen, you know, in terms of like, you know, I mean, my God bless her, my girlfriend, she was like, you know, for Halloween, I should be Lydia and you should be Beetlejuice. I'm like, lady, I can't plan that far ahead. What am I going to do? Be like, hey, Essie, I can't perform tonight. I got to be Beetlejuice. You know what I mean? Like, come on. So I try not to plan ahead. And, you know, the other day I was riding my bike to this. I was, you know, shooting this commercial and it was in Brooklyn. I'm riding my bike in the morning. I'm listening to music. I'm like, what the fuck more do I want? This is great. I would ultimately love to, you know, have a show where I get to tell the story of my life and, you know, write and star in it and use that as a way to have people come out and see me on the road to kind of spread this crazy message of love and weird acceptance.
What is your relationship like with Esty now?
You know, I was so nervous to be around her for a while. Rightfully so. I don't ever want to step on anyone's toes or feel like I'm, you know, an annoyance or anything. It was very much like deference, like, hello. And I still, you know, feel that way. But at a certain point, she like gave me a hug and a kiss one time. And I was like, what the fuck? Holy shit. You know, and she.
What prompted that?
I don't know. And she ended up telling me that she likes having me around because I'm, you know, positive and everything. And the other day she was kind of saying really nice things about me at the table in front of people. I was like, oh my God. And she's an incredibly interesting woman. And so is Noam.
She is fascinating.
So is a waitstaff there. I was just talking to a waitress who's, you know, she went to theater school and she got a master's in acting in London. And it's like, everybody has these stories. And I just love sitting and like listening to these crazy tales, you know, like this guy, Lenny Marcus, who's an absolute crusher. He was telling me about how like in the early 90s, it was like really dead, you know, and it was when you could smoke in the club, when you were like bombing, you could hear the paper burn on the cigarette, you know, and it's just so funny. They turn like 1,000 people away at night now. It's like crazy to imagine that. And Essie's just so interesting. And she just has like this, you know, like you want to be on everyone's good side, but you know, she has so many stories. So to like
have her have these moments of sharing them is just like, you know, sitting around like a campfire and hearing like a great ghost story, you know.
Does she give you feedback on your sets now?
No, I mean, the other day she was very complimentary towards me in terms of getting the room and being funny and good at my job. And so I'm going to hold that
close in your
heart to me for a very long time. You know, I can get really down a lot. And I know a lot of people do, but I try to, when good things happen, I try to write them down so that when I get really fucking low, I can look at it and be like, oh, here's proof that you can get there again.
What is it like when you sit at the comedian's table now? You feel at home there yet?
You know, sometimes, you know, the other night I went and nobody was really talking to me. And
who was at the table?
It was Bobby Kelly, Michelle Wolf, Ryan Hamilton, Keith Robinson, Mateo Lane, and nobody was talking to me. And I was just like, well, that's just what it is. You know, some nights you walk in, you see a table and you go, well, I'm going to do an about face and leave, you know.
Wait, if it's like Seinfeld and Chappelle. And...
Yeah. I have no place being there.
You're not going to sit at that table?
No, I am not going to try
to sit
there.
Has that ever happened?
Oh, of course. You know, I know my place. I know who I am.
You're like,
I know
pivot.
I'm just a little puppy in this world of big dogs. You know what I mean? So it's a thing of like, I'm very self-aware, you know, and there's some people I feel comfortable with and I'm getting more comfortable with, but I go and I sit down, no one's talking. I didn't even notice. And one guy's eating like a chicken parm and I'm like, that looks delicious. And he's like, it's really good. And then Bobby goes, what the fuck? I told everyone not to talk to him. And he's like, well, you're just so nice. I couldn't help it.
Wait, who was the guy? Who did you say that to?
Ryan Hamilton. Oh. He's like the sweetest, kindest guy ever. He's like, well, I don't know, I forgot, you know.
Oh,
but it's
so
fun,
funny.
You know, that's like even before I was in at the cellar, Bobby played this fucking prank on me. It was a Christmas party, and a buddy of mine who's so fucking funny, who like has really helped me out a lot, Monroe Martin, he's a comic from Philly, he's so fucking great, and he brought me to the Cellar Christmas party, right? And you know, being around long enough, you know these comics and you become like friends, you familiar faces, so I'm, you know, there and I'm seeing people, but I'm very nervous because I don't work there and it's a holiday party for like Cellar employees, comics that work there. I'm sitting down eating, and Voss and Bobby like talk to the manager, and Liz comes up and she goes, hey, what's your name? And I go, Ian Fidance. And she goes, yeah, why are you here? Like, what? And she goes, do you work at this club? And I go, no, I don't. She goes, well, you can't be here and you have to
crushing.
Leave your food. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And I got up and fucking Bobby and Voss are like giving me the finger. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I mean, I went white. You know what I mean? I was just so scared. And, That was fun because I obviously there's like a little thing of like, hey, we kind of like you, you know, we're fucking around with you. If they didn't, that wouldn't happen, you know. So it was like really nice. And again, it goes back to that like family community type thing, you know.
You didn't write that down in your book of affirmations that Liz told you to get?
No, I just kept that in my nightmares for years, you know. Maybe pump the brakes. I'll feel uncomfortable for a while.
Well, thank you so much.
This was so great. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Working. Thanks for listening. Again, I'm your host, Laura Bennett. If you liked the show, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. If you have any questions or comments, you can write to us at working@slate.com. Working is produced by Jessamine Molly. Special thanks to Justin D. Wright for the ad music. Come back next week for another episode on New York's Comedy Cellar.